you need to learn contentment. And that's something I've learned during my life, during the time. There's actually a good quote from Charles Dickens. I can't remember which book it's from now, but he said that happiness means an income of £20 and expenditures £19 and 19 shillings. Unhappiness, misery, income £20, expenditures £20, 1 shilling. So it's just to teach you to live within your means. And to have enough is relative, isn't it? I mean, if you've got $20, just spend $19, or $20, don't spend $21.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we talk to inspirational leaders from all over the world to dispense wisdom for life, business, and career in order to provide you shortcuts to excellence. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of Professional Development Forum and your host today. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age find fulfillment in the modern workplace. Today, we're joined by Dr. Andrew Browning. Andrew is a distinguished Australian obstetrician who has spent his entire career volunteering in Africa as a medical missionary. He has cared for over 12,000 women across Africa and Southeast Asia. He helped establish charities in Ethiopia and Tanzania to build free maternity hospitals for the poor, train midwives, and prevent fistula. These charities and hospitals have overseen the safe delivery of over 80,000 women to date and has trained nearly 1,000 midwives. He founded the Barbara May Foundation in Australia to fund those hospitals. He is an expert in obstetric fistula. He has developed new surgical techniques that are now standard practice across the globe. He advises the United Nations and the WHO on fistula and related issues, and is a frequent keynote speaker at international medical conferences. He oversees FIGO, the International Federation of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Global Fistula Surgery Training Program. He serves as the chair of FIGO's Fistula and Genital Trauma Committee, an expert advisory group on obstetric fistula. He has over 57 publications in medical literature. And in fact, the textbook on fistula surgery, which he's co-written with Brian Hancock, is distributed to all FIGO fistula trainees. Andrew has recently written a memoir titled A Doctor in Africa, sharing his story about working in remote locations and overcoming harsh conditions while transforming the lives of countless women. He was awarded a member of the Order of Australia for his services to international maternal health. Congratulations for living such an outstanding life of service, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, before we jump into the lessons, I must ask, and I'm sure this is on the mind of everyone that's listening, what is obstetric fistula and why is it such a terrible condition?
I think that's probably easiest to teach you what an obstetric fistula is if I tell you a story of one of my patients. And I've, as you said very kindly in your introduction, I've cared for over 12,000 women with obstetric fistula, and I've personally operated on well over 7,000 of them now. I'm just about to go back to Africa. We're over 100 more patients waiting to operate. I'll tell you the story of a patient called Ngolo, who was one of my patients in East Africa. One of my last patients that I treated before moving back to Australia, where I'm based now, and I commute back to Africa. But Ngolo lived in an area of East Africa that didn't have any access to obstetric care or medical care. The nearest hospital to where she lived was 120 kilometers away. They had no money, no transport, no communication. And that's actually how the vast majority of people, women, live around the world. Very few women live the way we do in Australia, or at least the world. So her situation was that she didn't go to school. There was no school that she could go. Well, there was a school, but the boys went to the school rather than the girls. And so at a very early age, as soon as she started to have a period, she got married. And she found herself pregnant at the age of probably around 15. And she went into labor in her little mother-in-law's hut in the village. After a full day of labor, Ngolo still hadn't delivered her child. She was one of the 5% of women all around the world, Australia, Africa, Asia, that get into what's called obstructed labor, meaning the baby's just getting stuck. Either the mother's pelvis is too small, or the baby's head's too big. For whatever reason, it's getting stuck. Here, In the resource-rich areas, we deliver at hospitals. That's recognised. The midwives call the obstetrician. The obstetrician comes in, gets paid a ton of money to do a caesarean. Everyone's happy, and they have a live baby and live, safe mother. But from Golo, no communication, no healthcare, not even a Panadol. So another day passed. So at the end of 2 full days later, she still hadn't delivered her child.
Wow.
Her husband, also a literate, he was desperate to know how he could help his wife. And he had the idea that if he boiled a basin of water and put Angolo's feet into the boiling water, it would stimulate her uterus to contract.
Mm.
Of course, that didn't work, but he did this for 2 more days. At the end of 4 days of labor, Angolo still hadn't delivered her child. She was now unconscious, and unconscious on the 5th day of labor, she delivered a stillborn or a dead child. It took her 2 days to regain consciousness. But when she did regain consciousness, she found that she was leaking uncontrollably from her bladder and also her bowel. Because she'd been in labor for so long, the baby's head was pressed against the bones of her pelvis, and all the tissues between, the tissues of the birth canal bladder, birth canal bowel, all those tissues had its blood supply cut off and all those tissues died. So after she delivered a stillborn child, all those dead tissues came away and she was left with a big fistula or a hole between the bladder, outside wall, rectum, outside wall. So she leaked urine and feces continually. She stank. She was ashamed. Husband divorced her. She went to live with her mother. The mother couldn't keep her in the house because she's not so bad. So she put her in a little mud hut on the edge of the family compound, and unable to walk because of burns on her feet, she stayed in that little hut for 18 months. So it was eventually found by a mission and brought to that hospital 120 kilometers away. And there were doctors in that hospital who tried to help her, but they hadn't been trained in fistula surgery. And they operated on her 3 times, but it didn't work. She was then found by our outreach workers and brought to me, to our hospital. And we operated on her. We operate on these ladies under spinal anesthetic. It's the safest anesthetic. It means that they're numb from the waist down, but they're awake during the operation. And Angolo had so given up hope that she could ever be cured that she just sobbed uncontrollably through the operation. It's a devastating condition for women. And we think there's about 2 million women in the world still waiting for treatment with this condition. But it's one of the few operations you can do as a surgeon that will completely transform someone's life. 40% of these ladies with a fistula are suicidal. They're universally depressed, often ostracized. Some of them are really still loved by their family, their husbands, but more commonly they're divorced and rejected. But we operated on Angola and we prayed for, of course, because I think doctors, there's an old saying I learned as a medical student that God heals, doctors get paid for it. I think it's the very truth. Golo had tubes in her bladder for 2 weeks after the operation while her tissues healed. And we removed those catheters, those tubes, and we give thanks that she was healed. And she was absolutely transformed, overjoyed. She was jumping up and down saying, look, I can't wait to get home. I'm never going to meet another man. I'm never going to be married again. I'm going to go to school and start a new life. And so we're very thankful that she did start to go to school and she is starting a new life and she has a new hope. So that's what an obstetric fistula is. And Golo's story is not unusual for me. As I've said, I've met 12,000, over 12,000 women, all with similar stories to Angolo, heartbreaking stories. And it's just been a delight to help them. But more importantly, we know we have to prevent them. And that's why I started the Barbara May Foundation to build hospitals so women can get to a hospital to deliver, have a caesarean. And so we won't see fistulas because we used to have them in Australia or America, Europe, in the 1800s, but they're eradicated now because all women can deliver in a hospital.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. It's actually really distressing to hear that still so many around the world suffer from something that we have all but eliminated and makes us realize how, I suppose, sheltered we are from some of the harsh realities around the world.
Yeah, the way we live is in the world's minority.
Mm.
The way people are golly live is the world's majority.
So it sounds like there's still a lot of work to do yet.
So it is.
All right. Well, let's just jump straight into the lessons then. Lesson number one, be satisfied, learn contentment. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I mean, the way I've lived my life, I've chosen to, or inspired to live my life, I guess, is of one of service. And it's meant that I and my family, we lived as volunteers in Africa for 17 years. We didn't have any income. We lived by faith. We just lived by people's donations to us. So friends or churches would give us money. And we lived a simple life, and we had to live a simple life. But it's sometimes difficult when I came back to Australia. I see all my colleagues and my friends. I mean, they've been very wealthy doctors, and they, you know, wonderful houses and cars. My car barely works. Cars that work, and they have exciting holidays. And you do feel a little bit, you're a bit jealous of that, but then it doesn't last long because you need to learn contentment. And that's something I've learned during my life, during the time. There's actually a good quote from Charles Dickens. I can't remember which book it's from now, but he said that happiness means an income of £20 and expenditures £19 and 19 shillings. Unhappiness, misery, income £20, expenditures £20, 1 shilling. So it's just to teach you to live within your means. And to have enough is relative, isn't it? I mean, if you've got $20, just spend $19 or $20, don't spend $21. And so that's something that we had to learn in Africa, just living off people's goodness. And we found that we just had enough to meet our daily needs, which is wonderfully reassuring. And actually, since coming back to Australia, I work for my charity now and I actually have an income. And I took quite a lot of, it was quite stressful for me to adjust to actually having an income. to live my faith. And, oh dear, I've got a budget now. And anyway, it's all worked out. You learn contentment. You learn that you can't have this, and don't seek to have those because it's unattainable for you. Just be satisfied with what you have.
Great. And so lesson number two, you said you came with nothing and you'll leave with nothing. Can you tell us a bit more about that one?
Yes. I mean, it kind of follows on from lesson one. I mean, I see my friends in Australia, just, you know, wealthy beyond my imagination and the vast majority of people anywhere in the world's imagination. But I mean, as an obstetrician and working as a doctor, especially in places like Africa, I mean, I've been into places like Sierra Leone, into war-torn Congo, into Somalia, South Sudan, all the difficult places, and you see a lot of suffering. But you see, as an obstetrician, you see the beginning and the end. I can't remember how many babies I've delivered, but it is a miracle when you see this new life, this new baby take its first breath, and see the delight in the mother's eyes. Well, usually the delight, sometimes they're actually exhausted. They're absolutely shattered and they can't even raise their heads. But soon they come around and they receive their baby with joy, this new life. But then you also see the end of life. I've been with people trying to resuscitate them. I remember one gorgeous, gorgeous young girl. She had an elective operation for fertility. And she had an extremely rare complication of clotting after the operation and got out of bed and she collapsed dead. And I spent a long time trying to resuscitate her. And we couldn't, it was hopeless. There was no way anywhere could bring her back. And you just see this gorgeous young person, 1 minute full of life, full of breathing, her character there, her soul. And then this body is just an empty shell and it's gone. And just in the blink of an eye. And that's the fate of everyone. We come into the world absolutely naked, you know, just taking a breath and screaming. And we leave our life, and all of us are going to leave life like that, or not dramatically like that, I hope. Hopefully some of us will leave life just peacefully in their sleep at a ripe old age. But we are going to leave life with nothing. And but during that period of life that we had, what are you going to focus on? Are you going to focus on accruing things materially? Because those things go, and nothing in this world really lasts. If the focus of your life is, you know, accruing money, then I've actually failed miserably. And I don't think that's the answer, because, I mean, the life that we have in a place like Australia is full of material wealth, although we don't really feel it. I mean, we have such power in our pockets, just in the mobile phone. We can speak to anyone in the world who also has a mobile phone. We can see anything. We have apart from lockdown times, you can travel anywhere in the world if we have the means. We live a life beyond the wildest dreams of anyone in history, but it doesn't have the answers. I mean, depression and anxiety are rife in our society. Suicide is rife. And I mean, I have met some of the world's richest people, people that are billionaires, and they fly to see what we're doing in Africa in their private jets. I've met royalty, European royalty. And I've met all the people right down to some poor women that were, you know, gang raped by 10 soldiers in the forest in Congo and stabbed and left for dead, and or a refugee in Eritrea who was literally buried in a hole with a corrugated bit of tin over him and in there for 5 years without half an hour a day to go to the toilet. People like that. I've met all different people, different walks of life, and everyone is the same. Everyone has the same issues, from the billionaires to the paupers. And they face the same issues. So, I mean, money to me doesn't have the answers. It's nice to have, but it doesn't solve the condition of the human spirit, and that we are coming to the world with nothing. We're going to leave the world with nothing. But I think the question is, are we going to leave the world a better place? What are you going to contribute to the world rather than take for yourself?
Wise words indeed. And it sounds like you've absolutely lived quite the life in terms of the people you've come across, the life experiences that you've had. So puts everything into that perspective. So thanks for sharing that. Lesson number three, where your treasure is, there is your heart.
A little bit cryptic perhaps. Yeah, I mean, that's more saying, what are you putting your values in? What are you pouring your heart into? One of the first hospitals I built was in Northern Ethiopia. It was an organization I was working for at the time. But I oversaw the construction and built up the staff and trained the staff and ran it for 5 years. And I poured my heart and soul into that hospital. We were treating about 600, fistula patients a year, just myself, two nurses and a few ex-fistula patients on staff and things. It was a delight. But, I mean, it didn't last. And it was just temporary because there was circumstances that, forced me to leave Ethiopia, and I left before, I could train the staff adequately, and which is very unfortunate because now it's just an empty, really, a shadow of what it was. There's hardly any patients coming. It's just all quite dilapidated. It was great while it lasted, but it just didn't last. And it devastated me just to see what had happened after I poured my heart and soul into that. It didn't last, but I want to now, it's taught me to put my energies into something that is lasting. And things like that, faith, they go. And I see in Australia, I mean, so much emphasis on youth and beauty, that plastic surgery is such a big industry. People are just seeking physical beauty and thinking that that may satisfy them and that may last, but that all fades. I mean, that I'm now over 50 and that's well and truly faded, if it was ever. And if you put your heart into something that's going to fade, I mean, you're going to live a pretty dissatisfied, unfulfilled life. There's an old African proverb, it's probably a little bit politically incorrect, but I'll say it anyway, that I've heard in Africa. It says, like, all people are beautiful until they open their mouths. because I mean, there's physical beauty in everyone, but the real beauty should come from your character. And that, well, that's to say that, unless you've got a good character, that beauty isn't there. I mean, I've met some in my life, I've been very privileged to meet, top models and the beautiful people. And when they open their mouth, you think, oh dear, I don't really want to be in your company. instead we should invest in our character, not a character that drives selfish ambition for your own and ruthlessness that might build up a successful business person. And I've also met very successful business people that I don't really enjoy their company because of that attitude. But I think that the character where I strive for is integrity and faithfulness, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness and goodness, and things like self-control. And those sort of things in your character, if you invest in those, everything else will follow. And so if we have a good character, I mean, even if people try to accuse you of doing wrong and being corrupt or whatever, it's not going to stick because you have had a good character And hopefully there'll be there's been plenty of people that have tried to accuse me of doing wrong. And sometimes, yes, I've done wrong, and I'm thankful that they accused me of doing that and kept me accountable. But other times it's all been completely false. But if you strive to have a character of integrity, yeah, then that everything else in your life will follow.
Absolutely. What makes one's character desirable?
Yeah, well, I think those values of joy and love and peace and thankfulness, positive attributes to your character. And that will give you a good name and build up your reputation. So, I mean, reputation follows character, I think. I mean, I've met, again in my life, some very, very poor people, but they have such strong character, such lives of integrity, such honesty, such truthfulness, and such a giving character. You just delight in being in their company, and you learn so much from them, even though they're materially poor, maybe they're physically very unattractive. What you see their character, their inner beauty just shines through, and you think these are absolutely gorgeous, wonderful people.
That's a very good point, because you can't help but to be drawn to people with character. Is that something that's fundamental to all people? Is that just the way we're made, that we are actually attracted to these characters? Or
I think there's an underlying truth in that. Those values of goodness are attractive to all people. And I think there's an old saying that you don't overcome evil with evil, you can overcome evil with good. And there was a very outstanding Ugandan, I'd never met him, but I heard him speak. He said that he lived through Idi Amin's time. And he said, "I don't carry a gun, I carry love." Right. And he overcome evil just by sheer goodness and love. Yeah, and I think when people see that love and goodness, they recognize it. I think that's a common thing across all humanity.
And you can say it with experience too, having lived your life around in those places. So lesson number four, look out, not in.
Yeah, so I think, as you were alluding to before, looking out to the needs of others is far, far more satisfying than any sort of wealth that I've not accrued wealth, but that I could have. Yeah, so, I mean, people like Ngole, just to see the joy in their heart, and I've seen that joy in people, thousands of people. Some of the fistula patients you can't cure, and it breaks your heart. It's just tragic. And it makes you want to, you cry on the inside, you sometimes cry with the patients, but you want to serve the others. And so a life of service and looking out to the needs of others rather than the needs of yourself just has given me so much more satisfaction and joy in life.
Yep. So have you always had that approach to life? I mean, was there a time when you were looking in and not out?
Oh, absolutely. There's still times in my life that I look in, and the times that I look into the needs of myself, I start to get a little bit down because my needs never met. But when I meet the needs of others, it just certainly shifts that emphasis from yourself to others and serving others, and that just puts your life into perspective, and the service of others just gives many people, not just me, a life of a more depth and satisfaction.
Absolutely. And lesson number five, let no debt remain apart from the debt to love each other. That sounds very profound. And I must admit, I don't really know what that means.
Yeah. So let no debt remain apart from the debt to love each other. I'm a middle-aged white Australian male, and speaking about feelings and love and that sort of thing is a little bit, it's not what middle-aged white Australian males talk about, but the carrying a good character and wanting to love and to serve, that's been the basis of how I've been living my life. That's been the rock bed, I suppose. And I don't want to be indebted to anyone, but just have a debt to love everyone around you more. And that's recognized. I remember actually once I was invited as a very young person, relatively young, I was 32 or 33, I think, and I invited to give a what's called a state of the art lecture to a big scientific conference in Holland. Something like 2,000 or 3,000 people in the audience, all, very critical medical scientists and doctors and whatever. And I presented my science, but I also spoke mainly about the women we served and what we do to serve them. And, I got a standing ovation from everyone in the house. And it wasn't because, people were appreciative of the science. As a young fella, I don't think my science is particularly fantastic or inspiring, but they recognized a life of service and love given to these patients. And that's what they gave the standing ovation to. And yeah, I think we need to continue our service of love. And I mean, people often ask me, you know, you've done a lot of things in your life. What's your biggest achievement? Was it, you know, giving this address to a scientific thing when you're so young, or building a hospital, or, you know, helping these people? But I say, no. The probably the greatest thing that I've done, if I've achieved — I don't like that word achieve, because it makes you feel like you're striving to something. I'd rather serve. But if you're loving and you're serving, and if that leads you to having to build a hospital to stop people suffering like Ngolo suffered, but then you do it. And everyone has these experiences. I remember once I was up every night for 3 weeks, you know, into hospital and working during the day. I was absolutely shattered. At the end of 3 weeks, my first night, I probably wasn't going to get called to hospital. My son was up sick and I had to get up. You know, you're so tired and you can't even think because you're so exhausted, but you get up and you tend to your sick son, or you put your arm around a fistula patient and help her up, who's no one's even touched or come near to her in 10 years, and she's crying because someone actually loved her. But it's those moments of loving that's the greatest part of sharing with each other. Always just have a debt. That's the only debt you should have. Just debt to love others.
Debt to love others. That's very, very well said. Which is probably a good segue to the next lesson, lesson number 6, love is the common language. Can you tell us the story behind that one?
Yeah, very early in my career, I learned this. And I've worked cross-culturally across, I can't remember how many countries and how many tribes, how many cultures. I remember, you know, I was actually operated on a lady in Chad who was from a nomadic tribe on the Libyan border. And no one could speak her language. And she was actually the first woman from her tribe to ever come to a hospital. So they're all kind of watching, you know, see what happened to her. Just, hoping she gets better. But in all those circumstances, you know, care and compassion and love is seen through every culture. I remember one lady, she was actually in Ethiopia from around Somalia area. And she came, she was ostracized and she came a day's travel to get to us, but she had such horrific injuries. She just couldn't be cured. And I know it's dentist. I just wanted desperately for her to be cured and so she could regain her place in society. But she had injuries that, you know, no one could help. But I tried and it failed. And I had to explain to her through a translator that we tried and we did all we could, but you know, we just can't help her. And I thought that she'd just break down in tears, but she looked at me and she said, look, that doesn't matter because you've cared for me. You've loved me. You've helped me out. You put your arm around me when no one else in society even came near to me. And she said that for me, that's enough. And that was just a turning point in my life, just to realize, just to love another person is the greatest service that you can give them. Loving another person is something we all can do. Not all of us can be doctors and operate on these people, and not all of us, you know, can have the money to build a hospital or to fly around the world. But every person in the world, from the lowest to the highest, has the ability to love and share in the humanity, and that's a great equalizer across the whole world, across every single person.
Wow, that's that's very powerful right there. Thanks for sharing that. Indeed, if we all just love those that are around us, the world itself would just be such a much better place than it if we all just did it. Well, let's hope this message with the podcast reaches as many people as we can and inspire others to love. Thank you for sharing that. And lesson number 7, lead by coming last, being a servant.
Yes, I have found myself in positions of leadership, I guess, by founding different charities and building hospitals and being directors, different things here and there. The people that are, they're not under you because you're there to serve them as a leader and to build them up and to, for them to reach their potential. Even in our language, the word like prime minister means that you should be the first servant. And so leadership should be service to build people up. So for example, recently in one of our hospitals in Tanzania, the laws changed that you had to have a particular school documentation for you to be a nurse. So we've had some very good nurses there that have been working with us for years. But all of a sudden they found that they couldn't be qualified as a nurse. And so the government's position was that they had to leave, but you know, they'd been loyal to us and we wanted to serve them. So we put them through school to get that bit of documentation that sponsored them. And now they're coming back to work. Back to legally. And there was another guy similarly in East Africa, very talented surgeon, one of the best doctors I've ever worked with. And he wanted to be specialized in obstetrician. So yeah, sure, we will serve you, we'll give you a sponsorship. So we found sponsors in America and Australia for him to go through to get his specialization as an obstetrician. And we didn't want to bond him because I knew this guy's character. He would do good for the people of his country when he had the qualification. And so, yeah, we wanted to serve him and give him that chance. So we didn't want him to come back and give anything back to us. And we supported him through, gave him advice, helped him in, you know, every circumstance. And now he came back to us and said, look, you've been good to me. I want to be good to you. So he's back on the staff now at one of our hospitals. And he's a very loyal, very, very good staff member. Doesn't mean that it's always going to work out like that. I mean, when you serve people, there's lots of people out there that are just going to take advantage of you and take it and abuse them right away. But hopefully in time that they'll see what you've done and be a better person for it. So yeah, just lead by serving and investing in people.
Wow. That's very profound. But, well, just go back to that point, because that was very interesting. You said that, you know, there are people who will take advantage of you when you go in there with a servant mindset. How do you cater for that? Does that mean that you have to examine their character and qualify them before you choose to serve them? Or is it a case of just serve them and, you know, hopefully they'll change their mind?
It's a bit of both. I mean, you have to be wise as well. Yeah, you don't want to be completely ripped off and taken to town. Yeah, so you have to analyze things almost daily. I get asked for money by different groups of people, different individuals coming with stories. And so you do analyze case by case. And so you don't just give things blindly and irresponsibly. But if you see a genuine need, I think you try and meet it. Yeah, so yeah, you have to be careful of those people that are. I mean, you can run yourself ragged. Just getting yourself stressed and thinking, oh, is this person doing the wrong thing? And yeah, so actually, even at our hospitals, we offer free deliveries for all women, and we're meant to have poor women come. So we have certain criteria. But there's all sorts of people coming in trying to abuse the system, you know, richer people, you know, dressing up poor and pretending to be poor. But we have checks and balances. We try to keep that abuse to a minimum. There is going to be still some abuse, but you know, you have to set a limit. I mean, if you set the criteria so strict, it's going to exclude some poor people who really need it. I'd rather let in a few people that are abusing the system so we don't miss the poor people that actually need it. Yeah, so there's going to be an element of abuse, but you try and minimize it.
Thank you for that. And lesson number 8, be open to criticism.
But when I first went to Africa, I was really, I'd grown up in a small country town in New South Wales. I'd been to England a few times because I was born in England, but I'd never really experienced a different culture. And I guess I came with, an imperialistic attitude. We knew best and we could teach people and I could teach people and I had lots of answers, but yeah, I certainly didn't. And I've actually learned far more from my African colleagues than I've actually ever taught them. More about, you know, understanding, more about humanity, more about living. Yes, I'm a much, much richer person for having spent, you know, 20 years of my life in Africa with African people. And yeah, and that's because they've criticized me. they've pointed out that, you know, you're not always right. We do it this way. This way actually works better in this context. And, you know, I slowly started to realize, yeah, they're right. I mean, what works in Australia doesn't work in South Sudan or Uganda or Congo, whatever. You have to learn, sit back and learn from these people and then work collaboratively to see how you can improve things. And so, yeah, if I wasn't open to that criticism and wasn't open to hearing correction, yeah, I don't think I would have, you know, done anything useful in my life.
Well, that's a very wise observation, right? So, I mean, it does take us an amount of humility and awareness to be able to be open to such criticism. The key was for you to be able to see that the Australian context does not apply to South Sudan, for example. So how did you develop that sense of awareness and humility to be able to accept criticism?
I think that just comes back to the basic thing of love. If you love those people that you're with, you love those people that you're serving, they soon realize that. And but if you come with an arrogant, you know, dictatorial, I know best attitude, that'll just put barriers, it'll put divisions, hostility. But if you have an openness and a love, I've been trying to make it the foundation of the way I live, And then people recognize that they see that they see that you're trying, they see that you're kind to them, that you're accepting of them, and spending time with them too. I mean, just, you know, spending time in the house with the family, eating, inviting them to your house, eating, building up those relationships. That's the best investment you can do is into people, loving them and learning from each other. There's a great deal you can learn from each other to make you a better person in this world a better place.
Absolutely. So let's move on to lesson number 9. Now, I like this one. There is nothing new under the sun.
There's nothing new under the sun. All these things that I've been talking about, there's that's old wisdom. Some things that just haven't changed. As I said a little bit earlier, I've committed my life to Christ as a 14-year-old. Gave my life to Christ. Every principle that I've been talking about is from the Bible. And some of which has been written 3,500 years ago. I mean, we live in a world that is vastly different to the biblical world when the Bible was actually written. I mean, as I said before, we have these devices in our pockets that are so powerful. We can fly, we can communicate, we can, you know, do this on Zoom. Who would have thought? I'm sitting, you know, 100 kilometers away from you. We're talking to each other and seeing each other like this. Extraordinary. I mean, you know, in biblical times, the fastest anyone could go was on a horse. And that was like that for until the 1800s. So we live in a very different world. But wisdom and the human condition is exactly the same. But even our science changes. Actually, I like collecting images of old things and what we've learned from history. Behind my desk, I have a map of Africa that was actually drawn in the 1500s. It's from the world's first atlas. And the shape of Africa is completely wrong. The rivers are completely wrong. It's all made up. There's mountains that are all wrong. It's just what they would, you know, think it would be like. Then I've got a map of Africa from the 1850s. The shape of Africa is better. The rivers and mountains are better. They're still not like our maps today. The political boundaries are not there at all. It's just completely changed to the maps of Africa that we have today. So, I mean, just in that time, our science has changed so much, even just map drawing, you know, where we live is changed dramatically. But I've also got copies of the Bible that was written 800 years ago and 500 years ago and today, and it's exactly the same. The words are exactly the same, or slightly different, these, thous, and wherefores. But the phrasing and the meaning is exactly the same. God's word hasn't changed. That wisdom that people learned 3,000 years ago that speaks to the human condition is exactly the same. People have followed, have the same issues, relationships issues, their ambitions and selfishness and money is, you know, a temptation that can bring the worst out of people. And that's exactly the same 3,000 years ago. I mean, I've seen families divide over inheritances. Awful. You know, the parents die and the kids fight over the inheritance. Just the money often brings out the worst of people. Exactly the same as it happened 3,000 years ago. I mean, humans haven't changed. So there's nothing new under the sun of that. You know, everything that I've learned is nothing new. It's been around for thousands of years.
That's right. No amount of iPhones going to change human nature.
Yes.
I was right.
Well, and what makes human nature worse, bring out the worst of human.
So you don't think this age of instant gratification, you know, tweeting and influencers and Instagram, you don't think this has changed at all for the better or the worse?
I think there's, with everything, there's good things and bad things, isn't there? It's wonderful to be able to know what's happening with people all around the world. What you do with that information is I don't know. And it's because you should be living in your immediate environment with the immediate people. Yeah, but I mean, it's good to be able to communicate like we are now. We couldn't do this during lockdown without that. Yes, there's good things and bad things, but, you know, every technology can be used for good or evil. I mean, a lot of bullying and sexting and, you know, all those abuses that is going on with those useful tools. But also damaging things can happen with them as well. So then what's lying behind that is human nature, which is either using it for good or for evil. And yeah, that hasn't changed at all in thousands of years.
Yeah. And no amount of technology is going to make people good.
No, not at all.
So if there are evil people driving the world, potentially the technology could be dystopian in its nature and be used in completely the wrong way.
Yes.
So it's not enough just to have technological progress. We have to remain orientated to pursue what's good and what's right and righteous.
Yeah, work on their character.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we'd love to throw our wise guests usually one of these curveballs. Before we get on to the last lesson, what I want to ask you is there any lesson that you have unlearned? And what I mean by that is there anything that you have held to be this ironclad truth that you've always thought to be true that you've learned through your years that is just not the case?
Yeah, and that's a little bit like from my point about receiving criticism, that's that I just don't have all the answers. There's a lot I can learn. I mean, when I first went to Africa, I did think like that, that I did, you know, have the answers, and that, yeah, it caused a lot of trouble, created a lot of divisions until I learned to sit back and listen and learn and look and love and serve. Yeah. So yeah, always be open to criticism. Don't be arrogant, and think that you have the answer, that you're always right. Yeah. Be open to learn.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And lesson number 10. And this one sounds very profound. And again, I must admit, I don't know if I really comprehend this properly. You say lesson number 10 is, all is empty if all that we see is all that there is. All is empty if all that we see is all that there is. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm thinking, all that we see in this material world, if that's the only thing there is, and we're just here, just coming into the world of nothing, leaving the world of nothing. And while we're here for these brief few years, if this is all that there is, then all those values and all those wisdom that I was talking about, I mean, what's the point? Why not live just for yourself, just accrue wealth, enjoy life as much for yourself as you possibly can? Yeah, but if there's something behind it, if there's some truth behind it, something beyond what we can see and touch just with our eyes and our hands, and our ears and listen to where there is, then it will change many things. I mean, I've been very privileged in that I've had a good upbringing in a nice, comfortable country town in New South Wales. I went to Sydney Uni to get my medical degree. I mean, I had a fantastic education that's enabled me, equipped me with the skills and the knowledge to do what I've done, but it didn't actually instill any values in me. It didn't give me the framework to think and to live by. I'm very honored to get an award from Sydney Uni just earlier this year, actually, and it was for services to humanity. And my acceptance speech, so I have to be honest with them and try and get them to think that, you know, I said that, you know, Sydney Uni has given me a fabulous education to qualify me as a doctor, and the reputation that, you know, Sydney University has put me in good stead to be able to do what I've done. But though that did that, it didn't give me any values. My values came from somewhere else. And the same, my old boss in Ethiopia, when I first went there and worked with her for 10 years, a lady called Dr. Catherine Hamlin, she was a wonderful, wonderful, gracious lady and received Australia's highest awards. And people used to call her a great Australian, as if to say that you know, being Australian made her do what she does. But she was the first person to say, oh, that's a load of nonsense. Being Australian has been wonderful. It's given you every opportunity in life, but it hasn't taught you what to do with those opportunities. Mm. So for both of us and for many other people in the world, the motivation, the inspiration for doing what we do, a life of love and a life of service, has come from something beyond what we can see. So recently I was on another interview and we were talking about a similar thing. And I asked the lady, you know, she was doing some interesting things. And I said, what's the inspiration for you to do these things? Because she's living a different life. And she said, well, I get my refreshment and I teach other people to get refreshment just by going out into nature and just looking at the beauty of nature. And I said to her, well, I mean, that's good. But I mean, if there's something beyond that, I mean, wouldn't you get more strength from actually knowing the creator of that nature rather than looking at his creation? And that was probably the turning point in my life. When I was at 14, I wasn't going to a big university or, you know, some international conference or, you know, building a hospital or whatever. The turning point was really when I was 14. I was in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. It was a freezing cold winter's night. It was blowing a gale. It was raining. It was miserable. We went to a youth rally in a church in a tiny, tiny town. And that's when I heard the news that God was who he said he was. He was real. He came as a person in the form of Jesus Christ, and he died and rose again to defeat death and give you hope of knowing God, knowing your creator, and living beyond what we see now into where our spirit will be with him into the future, past our death. And that just filled me with absolute joy. It transformed the way I think. And but if that's real, it is the most significant point in history where God actually came as a man to have a relationship with us. And it would be so significant that you'd want to base your calendar around it before Christ and in the year of our Lord, which is exactly what we've done. So is that real? And then I found that at the age of 14 to be a real truth. And so for me to find that truth, that I can know my creator and get inspiration for me, and he gives me the strength to live a life of love and service, has transformed my life. And it's given me the strength to look beyond what we see and hear and touch, and just in this finite, fading, material world, into something that maybe there is a creator behind it, and we can know him. And it just gives you a life of joy and love that you want to share with other people. And it's not just peculiar to me and my old boss, Catherine Hamlin. There's been millions of people sharing that hope and joy. And it's true to say that 50% of healthcare in Africa is provided by Christian mission. And that's an enormous amount of work that people who have come to know Christ and our creator, our God, has been inspired to do this work. It's a huge amount of work that's been done in the world. 45% of education is provided by the church. People want to serve, and they get that inspiration to serve by looking beyond what's in this material world to beyond, and knowing their creator. So that truth, if you can find a truth and stick by it, that's beyond what we see and hear, that's given me tremendous strength in my life. There's sometimes in my life that I doubt and think, oh, gee, am I crazy? Yes, it's true. But then I just fall back to it. It's the only thing that has made sense in all the different cultures, all the different situations that I've been in. It's the only common philosophy or worldview that makes sense of what I see and do and hear in this world.
Thank you. I realize that was a very deeply personal aspect of your life in terms of your faith. And I really thank you for sharing that. We recently had a discussion here at the 10 Lessons team about what is wisdom as opposed to what is intelligence. And we came to the conclusion that wisdom has an element of morality in there, in that it's not just how to grapple with the world, but it's indeed what is the right things to do. And I think you've given us a lot to think about in terms of what is the purpose of all this. And indeed, without the moral angle, what's the point? What's the point of all this? So this is indeed a very insightful lesson for me. I must admit, I really enjoyed your stories, and it just blew me away. You speak about not having a whole lot of material possessions, and yet you're probably one of the richest person I know in terms of what you've done. So thank you so much for sharing your story and the 10 lessons.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It's only as God has enabled me, I can tell you that I haven't had it on my own strength at all.
Thank you. And we'll finish on that note. You've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for career, business, and life. Our guest today was Dr. Andrew Browning, sharing the 10 lessons it took him 50 years to learn. This episode is produced by Robert Hosrey, sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which offers insights, community discussions, podcasts, parties, anything you want, anything you need, and it's all free. You can find them online at www.professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Don't forget to leave us a review or comment. You can even email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss an episode of the only podcast that make the world a little wiser, lesson by lesson. Thank you for listening, and stay safe, everyone.